This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests that are designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. The show is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, but serving the entire Washington, D.C. area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OFP, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. Also, please subscribe to my blog at blueprintforwealth.org, which has videos, audio, and special articles on topics of interest to you in the estate and business planning area. And also, finally, make sure that you read my Washington Business Journal article every month, usually the first Friday of every month. Today, we're going to be talking about how to divide your tangible personal property. It's not an easy issue. In fact, it takes up more time than it's worth because usually it's one of the least valuable assets in your estate when you pass away. The last thing a parent wants is to have kids arguing about who gets particular items of furniture or jewelry or other family valuables. These things are known as tangible personal property, or called personal property, and they're contrasted with real estate or stocks and bonds, which are totally different types of assets. In a first marriage, there's usually no particular family complications. Mom and dad leave their personal property to each other. If there are kids, the surviving spouse typically will leave all the personal property equally to the kids, and maybe there are going to be adjustments made where there are specific items of property that the parents wish to go to particular kids. For example, mom may naturally want her jewelry to go to her daughters or daughters-in-law rather than her sons. Dad may want his gun collection or his watch to go to a son rather than a daughter. Sometimes there are specific items of furniture or artwork or specific kinds of tangible personal property that you want to leave to a particular kid, like a piano or a violin, or in my case, a saxophone, when that child plays the instrument. Now, many states like Virginia allow individuals to leave a separate memorandum on how they want personal property to go. This allows you to change your designation from time to time without going through the formality of changing your will. This rule does not apply in Maryland and D.C., which means that every time you want to change your list, you've got to execute it with the formalities of a will, which means go to a lawyer. If one child gets more property than another, you can make an adjustment to help equalize matters by having a lump sum of cash or other property distributed to the kids who did not get particularly valuable items of property. This is an option that sometimes is used when mom and dad are concerned about trying to make things as equal as possible. A lot of parents aren't that concerned about those things. If there's a lot of tangible personal property, then you may want to adopt the following mechanism. I call it the rotation method. Let's say the executor, the person who's responsible for gathering all the assets, is directed to place approximate valuations on items of all personal property in the estate. Each kid then has a chance to choose in rotation. For example, let's assume that there are items of personal property that have a total value of $20,000, and there are four kids, A, B, C, and D. Each kid would be entitled to $5,000 worth of property. Of course, each item of personal property may not have equal value. So each kid, in rotating order, is going to select a particular item. A goes first, B goes second, and so on, until the child has selected items totaling $5,000. Well, what if one of the kids picks a particularly valuable item? as the first choice? And what if it's, you know, constitutes 3/4 of the value of all of the items? Well, obviously, there would have to be an equalization made later on. If you're a single person with no kids and you want to leave personal property to other relatives or friends, you can do this using the rotation method as well. A little extra language in your will or in a living trust is required to cover these contingencies. In the long run, paying attention to these details, however, may be well worth the trouble because it's going to avoid arguments or disagreements that could arise after you're gone. In a family where husbands and wives have been previously married, the division of personal property becomes especially complicated and may generate a lot of ill feelings, depending on how much detail you devote to how the property is going to flow following your death. For example, the personal property of each partner shouldn't automatically be given outright to the other partner, although the duration of the second marriage may affect this overall decision. So, if people have been married for a relatively short period of time and there are kids from the first marriage, the kids from the first marriage may expect to receive a distribution of the decedent's personal property rather than leaving it to the spouse. You, as the person writing your will, you as the person giving that property away, need to consider this. And with proper planning, you can handle this in a way that won't offend either side. On the other hand, if you've been married a long time and the second marriage is really viewed by everybody involved as the overall, you know, good marriage of the parties, then you may want to leave your assets, all your tangible personal property, all your other assets to your surviving spouse, depending on how things are playing out in the estate planning overall. Now, I've seen major conflicts develop between a second spouse and kids of the first marriage, where there were a number of valuable antiques, for example, or a silver collection among the personal effects of the decedent. Sometimes the controversy starts before the actual death occurs, like one of the spouses becomes ill. Not long ago, I was asked by kids of a wealthy executive who was hospitalized with terminal illness to work with them because they were concerned that the wife from the second marriage had basically done away with a lot of the personal property that the husband had accumulated during marriage. So the kids were concerned that the wife was taking property that really didn't belong to her. Well, how do you avoid something like that? For the decedent, you would go through their house with a video camera and take a video or take pictures of the personal property that exists in the premises of the decedent before he gets sick, while he's still healthy, while she's still healthy, while she's still able to understand what the objects of her bounty are, and then compare it to what is there after they're gone. Because if something's missing, then that might lead to the discrediting of the second spouse or the kids, depending on who's in charge of handling these assets. Now, when you're dealing with more valuable pieces, you may want to have them removed from the house and put into a safe place. If the kids don't want them, if the kids don't want the asset itself, you may want to consider giving the executor the power to sell these assets. There are lots of auction houses around the area that can conduct online auctions and in-person auctions to maximize the value of what you get for your personal property after you're gone. Now, a lot of us view the value of our property as being a lot higher than it actually is. In other words, if you bought something at retail, do you think that you'd be able to sell it at retail following your death or even before you die? And the answer is typically no, because there's a markup that's paid above wholesale for your personal enjoyment of that particular item. That particularly applies to jewelry. Jewelry may be marked up 2 to 3 times higher than the original cost paid by the retailer for that item. So what could you expect to get for that item if you were to sell it on the open market? Well, the answer is most likely you're going to get a wholesale price, a price that doesn't include the retail markup. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't insure your tangible personal property while you're alive. For example, you can buy insurance that will protect you to the extent of the retail value or the replacement cost of tangible personal property, particularly jewelry, that you want to make sure that if it is lost or stolen, you can recover the value of that asset by making a claim against your insurance, subject to deductibles. But the idea is that in your estate, you don't want to have fights. You want to make it as easy as possible for everyone. So, for example, you may want to meet with your kids before you pass away, before you get sick, and really figure out what, if anything, they would like to have of yours. And put their names on it. And put values on it. And by dividing the assets up among the kids in a fair fashion, that way you will get a result that the kids will not be upset afterwards, after you go, and they will not, it will not result in a fight that could end up in court. I'll give you an example of how these things really can devolve into a bad situation. The executor of the estate is the person responsible for gathering all the personal property of an individual after they're gone. So let's say you are married and you leave everything to your spouse. That's easy. That's the easy answer. What happens when your spouse dies? Your spouse is appointed, say, one of four kids to serve as the executor. Well, I've seen this situation happen. The kid who's appointed the executor comes into the house and starts removing tangible personal property from the house. The will said that the tangible personal property was to be divided equally among the children. The executor says that the executor is in charge of gathering the property, and the executor has the power to make the determination over how that property is going to be split up. To avoid any ambiguity, you want to make sure that you include details in your will, for example, if you're going to use this rotation method, that the executor is responsible for administering the estate the way you say it is to be administered. And if they don't, if the child goes in and starts removing tangible personal property in violation of the will or in violation of your trust or your wishes, the other heirs will have a cause of action in court against that executor. If you'd like to know more about how to leave your tangible personal property to your heirs, give us a call at 703-218-2100. Or visit my blog at blueprintforwealth.org. I'm Wayne Zell. You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth, and I hope you've got questions for us, because if you do, you can send them to radio@ofplaw.com.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in just a few moments.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
How does a potential plaintiff find out whether you've got enough money to make you an attractive lawsuit target? Thanks to the internet, a lawyer can find out everything he or she needs to know. It's well understood that internet search technology allows virtually unlimited access to your most sensitive personal and financial info. Detailed information describing real estate and business interests, the name of your bank and accounts, brokerage firm, your transaction history, all can be accessed and assembled without your knowledge or permission. Now anyone can find out what you have and how much you're worth. It's very different from the way it used to be, where there were scraps of paper and courthouses that had to be investigated and visited. All that has changed. An investigator can now sit in the comfort of his or her office with a computer, a modem, and a cup of coffee in one hand, and in minutes access everything he or she wants to know about you. Be careful about your personal information, and be careful about what you put on the web.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Len Wolf, director of The Wolf Group. Welcome, Len.
Thank you, Wayne.
It's great to have you on the show, and I'll tell you a little bit about Len, but before I do that, I've also got my partner here, John Dedon, of Dedon on Estate Planning and of Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Wayne. Great to be here.
It's great to have you again. John's going to conduct the interview. I'll just sit in the back and smoke a cigar. But before we start doing that, Len began his career with the international public accounting firm of Coopers & Lybrand. I spent some time there in my past, and he established the Wolf Group in 1983, so it's been around for a long time now, and he's directed its growth into the premier Washington-based CPA firm specializing in international and expatriate taxation. Len's involved in all kinds of organizations involving CPA activities and international tax, and he's also been part of the International Business Council of the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. He holds a CPA designation today, and he's a graduate of Penn State. He's got a wife and lovely children and lovely wife, and welcome to the show, Len. John, take it over. Let's hear all about Len's background.
Well, you know, it's a little intimidating to be here with two CPAs, but I'll try to do my best. Len, you started your firm back in 83. I think we probably met in about 90. How did you get started?
Well, you know, I was originally out of college living up in New Jersey, and I did an internship with a Big Four public accounting firm when I graduated from school. I found myself sort of in a social rut up there in New Jersey, hanging around with the same people I was hanging around with in high school, real close to the family, loved my family, but being around the corner wasn't nearly as exciting as being away in college. And so decided to pick another area to move to live to open my world back up to me as it had opened up to me in college, and picked Washington, D.C., came down here, went to work with a defense contractor down here, a company called BDM, was with them for about 3.5 years before I started my practice.
Earl Williams.
Right? That's right, Earl Williams, Ran for governor 1 year, not too long after I started there.
Well, I know you're a Penn State guy. There are a bunch of Penn State alum down in this area. It's an interesting transition. How did you get from being an in-house accountant to ending up starting your own firm?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, John. I guess, you know, it doesn't take too many days and nights of working perhaps 12, 14, 16 hours a day and waking up in the middle of the night with the few hours of sleep that you had in between that work schedule, worrying about a meeting or, as we would call it, a briefing in the morning with your senior executives, to wonder, in fact, should I be doing this for myself or should I be doing it for the shareholders of this company? I concluded that I ought to be doing this for myself. And I guess I did have that just, you know, call it that. I know it's an old cliche, but perhaps, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit in me just wouldn't die. I wanted to do something for myself. I wanted to build something. I wanted to grow something. I wanted to be able to look back in time and say, hey, last year we were here with this, and now we're here, and that's exciting. And I wanted a little bit more control over my career, and I wanted a bit more of a direct relationship between my effort and the rewards of those efforts. So decided to hang up my shingle and start my own practice.
Well, certainly that entrepreneurial spirit, I think, bodes well for the clients that that you have. You're able to actually have a shared experience in helping them, particularly your business clients.
Yeah, we love working with entrepreneurs. Whether they be small entrepreneurs or large entrepreneurs, we love working with entrepreneurs. I've often said I like working with the planning and the entrepreneurial aspects of business a whole lot more than I like working with the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have a great diversity of clients, but one of the areas that you really have an expertise in is in the international area.
Right. Yeah. We had so many great business decisions. We sort of fell into this area by accident. Not long after I started my practice, I ran into a woman who was in-house counsel at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. She had just left, actually, the IMF to start her own immigration law practice. And in that practice, she was serving a lot of clients who were leaving the IMF to become permanent residents of the U.S., get their green cards, which meant that they were moving from the status of non-resident taxation tax folks to resident tax folks. That is subject to a whole different set of tax laws. So she had questions for me on how these clients were going to be taxed under this new regime. At the time, I didn't know an alien, you know, from My Little Martian. But the more questions she asked me, the more answers I provided her. And one thing led to another. She introduced me to her successor at the IMF, who introduced me to her counterpart at the World Bank. And before you know it, I was doing a lot of work with the international organizations headquartered here in Washington.
Are you also handling, Len, the folks coming from overseas working under H-5 visas and the different types of visas that they're pretty much exempt from taxation in the United States? Do you have the opportunity to work with a lot of those folks as well?
We do. You know, it wasn't long after I started working with these international organization employees who are really like international civil servants, if you will, and they're taxed rather differently. Even while they're in the U.S., a lot of them are taxed as if they weren't living here in many respects.
Right.
But soon after working with those folks, I started working with more of the private sector, the executives, the corporate executives coming over from Western Europe and Asia. To spearhead operations in the U.S. that their companies were establishing here in the Western Hemisphere. So I was able to parlay that knowledge and experience that I had gotten working with the international organization employee colleagues and clients to the international executive that was coming over to establish corporate operations for their U.K. or French parent company here in the U.S. So now we have a very diverse set of clients, both we're serving international organization employees, we're serving the corporate executives, we're serving embassy personnel, we're serving people on the EB-5 program and other visa programs, just a cross-section of inbound foreign nationals to the U.S. And we're doing more and more work with Americans abroad as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know on the estate side, Wayne and I see a lot of issues with non-citizens who are still treated for estate tax purposes as subject to our estate tax.
Right.
And different tools they need to use, like a qualified domestic trust, in order to achieve a marital deduction. So I think it shows, Len, as we have worked together over the years, the type of interplay we have with you on the income tax side and Wayne and I on the estate side.
Yeah, and that's the intersection between income and estate taxation is rather interesting, because much to the chagrin of our clients, as you know, John and Wayne, the same terms are defined differently under both regimes. So
right.
One can be a tax resident for income tax purposes, but not be deemed a tax resident for estate tax purposes, and vice versa. So clients come to us and they say, oh, I'm a tax resident, and I think I know how I'm taxed for both income and estate taxation purposes. And then we have to inform them that the definition is different for income and estate tax purposes. So they can be a resident for income tax purposes and a non-resident for estate tax purposes, and vice versa. So it is quite interesting, the intersection between income and estate taxation.
Do you have to, Len, do you have to, at the Wolf Group, be familiar with all of the different treaties and treaty benefits that some of your executives and inbound folks are subject to?
We do, because first and foremost, we look to U.S. statutory law.
Right.
But under our system of government, the statutes and the treaties that we sign actually have equal weight. A lot of people don't know that. They think international treaties almost by definition supersede from an authority or an authoritative perspective the U.S. statute. But in fact, they're equal. If anything, it's a last to be enacted, first to be applied theory.
Hmm.
So if a treaty is enacted after a statute, in general, it rules the day. And vice versa, if a statute is enacted after a treaty, it can supersede the treaty.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, because that's something I didn't know. You know, Len, it seems like your expertise has grown so profoundly in this area. It's leading you to perhaps look at overseas offices.
That's right, John. In fact, we have a pretty exciting initiative underway now. We're looking to establish our first overseas office in Singapore. In fact, I met with a couple of folks in the last 2-3 weeks here in the States. They're from Singapore. They were traveling in the States, and we met, and I'm heading out to Singapore in 2 or 3 weeks with the objective of establishing the Wolf Group in Singapore. The objective there being to connect with the American expats. I mentioned we do Americans abroad as well as we do foreign nationals inbound to the U.S. Well, if an American company is sending Americans abroad, if we connect with the American executives here before they send those folks abroad, we have an opportunity to make a play for that engagement, if you will. But if they're on the West Coast and they're not aware of us and they don't contact us, they send those expats abroad unbeknownst to us. If we were on the ground with the expats in the host countries and we can connect with them there, And if they're not being adequately served by the firm that's serving them and their colleagues inbound in those host countries, we think they'd be inclined to go to their HR, their tax, their administrative managers, either in country there or back here in the U.S. and say, hey, we just ran into a firm. They're made up of CPAs. They're headquartered in Washington, D.C. in the U.S., but they have a presence right here in Singapore or Hong Kong or Bangkok. You really ought to consider these guys. That's all they do is international and expat rather than it just being a little part of what they do. Consider them. So it's a way for us to approach the market from a different direction, from the direction of the expat rather than the executive sending the expat.
There's a lot of expatriates on the ground in Singapore. One of my good friends and a client of mine he made his living over there for about 20 years and then finally came back to the States. And it's mostly U.S. multinational corporations that have significant operations out of there. How did you come upon Singapore? Or how did you decide Singapore versus Hong Kong or any other jurisdiction out there?
Right. Well, in part because there are a lot of American expats in that part of the world, but more importantly, because there are a lot of American expats everywhere in the world, the number of firms doing this type of work in that region are considerably fewer than, let's say, in Western Europe. There may be more American expats in Western Europe, but there are also many, many more firms serving them. We have found that in Singapore and in Hong Kong, there may be no firms that are really doing this at the level we're doing it. And so we feel that our competition, if you will, is almost non-existent in those countries.
Are there barriers to entry in those markets being a U.S. CPA firm?
There are none that we have really been able to find except overcoming, you know, the brand deficit, if you will, between ourselves and, say, the big four firms, because it's really the big four firms that have a presence in each of these cities around the world. But second-tier, third-tier firms, there really hardly aren't any. And as you gentlemen undoubtedly know, America is one of the very few countries in the world that taxes its American citizens on their worldwide incomes, regardless of where they live. So
right.
You can have an American who's lived in Singapore for 30 years, in fact, was born in America and moved to Singapore when they were the ripe old age of 3 months old. Their parents had them here. They were born here. They got an American passport because they were born here, brought them back to Singapore, lived there for 30 years, find out only then that they were subject to U.S. taxation for all 30 years that they were living in Singapore. And there's no statute of limitations that applies. That is, the U.S. government can't be enjoined from auditing them all the way back to the date of their birth, because that statute only begins to run once a return is filed. No returns filed, no statute of limitations.
Right.
And yeah, they could be looking at 31 years worth of U.S. returns. So it's a good market for us because Americans are taxed wherever they are around the world each and every year, whether they come back to the States or not.
In addition to the tax and accounting services, what do you all do at the Wolf Group?
Well, about a dozen years ago, we established an investment management practice. And in that practice, we develop portfolios for clients, fairly high net worth individuals, mostly expats themselves, foreign nationals in the U.S., again, or Americans abroad. And we do personal financial planning for them as well.
Excellent. Len, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in finding more about the Wolf Group?
Well, we have a website, certainly. That's www.thewolfgroup.com. And I personally can be reached at my personal email address, which is l.wolf, that's W-O-L-F, @thewolfgroup.com.
Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thank you, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
And make sure you check out John Dedon's blog at Dedon on Estate Planning. Google it and you'll find it. And blueprintforwealth.org. Thanks for listening and join us next week for Blueprint for Wealth.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent